Very happy to be in St. Cloud on this crisp fall day. We welcome everyone, both the visitors in the gallery and our esteemed counsel for oral arguments. We have 5 cases for oral argument this morning. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their opening argument. The respondent will have 15 minutes for their responding argument. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to make it. You don't always have to, but that's your call. You know, if you think you're winning, it's always a good idea to sit down and stop talking, but, you know, that's your case. The first case this morning is In Re the Estate of Norman Larson, deceased. Counsel for the appellant, if you're ready, just approach the podium, adjust the microphone to your level, and please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mike Ruffinock. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Alan D. Larson. We're here today because of a contest of a will that the decedent, Norman Larson, executed on January 24th, 2014. At that time, he's in a nursing home admitted for hospice and care following renal cancer, which was diagnosed and ultimately led to his death a few days later on January 30th, 2014. He had been in the hospital a few days earlier and was released to go home. He was supposed to follow up with a doctor for beginning treatment on his cancer. He didn't show. Social workers were called. They went out to his house. He was basically unresponsive. They brought him to the emergency room, and there was very little workup at that time because he was he had advanced cancer.
There's no dispute, I don't think, among the parties that he was in a very compromised, and you know, he was dying.
Right.
How does that, though, translate into he lacked testamentary capacity?
Well, the clear facts show from his medical illness that he was unconscious, being in a coma being unconscious, unable to respond, unable to make any decisions, come to the hospital within 24 hours. There was no test performed on his cognitive functions at the hospital or any time thereafter.
Does the law require that there be that type of evidence for a district court to determine that someone did have testamentary capacity?
Well, when the person is that incapacitated, the law requires that people the federal and state regulations for nursing homes require only that immediate family members be allowed into the nursing home. That's been set down for a long, long time.
But that's guidelines for the nurses. Is there any case law that says that translates into undue influence on the person writing the will?
If you can't be there, you have no people. I mean,
there's hospital policy, though. That what we're talking about is whether or not people exercise an undue influence on him. As I understand your first argument, which I'm actually wondering whether or not that's even waived or whether that's even properly before us. But let's just assume for the sake of argument right now that it is properly before us. What evidence is there of undue influence being exerted on Larson?
Just of the approaching of him in a very vulnerable condition.
People are vulnerable when they're on their deathbed, but you have to show that there's been some undue influence exercised on that person.
I think just by the very nature of his severe capacity, his inability to understand what was there based on the medical records. I mean, otherwise you basically threw out the requirements that the person be of sound and disposable mind. Anybody can approach him with a will, have him sign it, and then...
But on this record, I mean, it seems to be, again, undisputed that Mr. Larson, that his parish involvement was very important to him his entire life, and that he was a leader in that community. So why is it surprising, suggestive of undue influence, that he would make the testamentary decision to leave the bulk of his estate to his church family, if you will?
Because of he could have done that at any other time, and he didn't do it.
Well, he made significant gifts to the church during his life.
He
had never drafted a will. He was 81 and hadn't felt like he needed a will for whatever reason.
Right. But, you know, if he doesn't have capacity to draft a will, it doesn't matter if the church was totally honorable or totally unhonorable. He doesn't have the mental capacity, the mental functions, because of the severe depression he was in on the day the will was executed.
Okay, let me take it back. I'm trying to search for what's the evidence that supports your argument. As I understand it, the lawyer who drafted the will met with Mr. Larson, I think 2 days before he actually signed the will.
Yes.
So I think that person testified, and there were other, I think a nurse and another witness that testified about their observations of Larson, how he conducted himself, and they expressed their own conclusion that he knew what he was doing. He was able to articulate debts owed to him. He knew he was dying. He knew what he wanted to do with his estate upon his death. What's the countervailing evidence that the district court erred by failing to credit over the testimony of those three witnesses?
It's the overall diminished capacity that he was in, that he was in a very, very vulnerable condition. He wasn't using the bathroom. He was in severe depression. He had lack of fluid intake, lack of sensation. He had been in a coma before. There's no evidence of any significant cognitive function outside of the people that testified. None of them there was no foundation laid that any of them had examined his medical records from the, on the admission or anything else that basically put him in that condition. They basically ignored those things. There was no foundation laid. They didn't testify that was improper.
Did you object to the testimony of the three witnesses about their observations of Mr. Larson's capacity?
I believe that goes to the...
Mr. Rufinack, where, since we're talking about the medical records, sir, where would I find in the medical records, either mentioned in your brief, that specifically say mentally incompetent? And here I'm looking at pages 1 through, I guess it goes on to 4. I mean, I see, actively dying, admitted to hospice, severe depression, I hope I pronounced this correctly, peripheral neuropathy, decreased manual dexterity. I honestly didn't see anything that said, dementia, mentally incompetent, delusional. I didn't see anything like that. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct on that.
So, okay, thank you.
I mean, he was, having had the the whatever condition it was, whether it was a stroke or what it was, being unconscious for, you know, basically 24 hours. I think there's a strong, you know, and they never performed any tests of his cognitive abilities.
Okay, can I ask you a question on that? I'm looking at the district court's findings and order, and finding number 19 is that Mandy Larson, a nurse at the Golden Living Center, completed cognitive assessments and believed decedent was aware and competent to sign the will. Are you saying that's a clearly erroneous finding of fact? I mean, did Mandy Larson not complete cognitive assessments?
I'm not sure. I think she completed cognitive assessments. But I think the fact that, you know, there was that major stroke or whatever have you strongly influenced it. The fact that the day he executed that will, he was suffering from severe depression of, you know, and basically that's what she made the decision the day the will was executed that he needed started of the hospice care. That was on a Friday. That care started immediately the following Monday when the doctor signed off on that. I think that, you know, it clearly indicates that he, you know, if he was in a suicidal condition, those conditions don't come on overnight.
No, I mean, on that point, on that specific point, I did not see any indications in the medical records of suicidal ideation. Is that correct?
They basically said that he was, you know.
Well, I didn't see the word suicidal ideation in the records.
No.
Okay, all right.
So. But I have a more general question. Did the issue of undue influence, was that raised at the district court at all?
Pardon?
Was the issue of undue influence? Did you raise that before the district court?
I believe I did, Your Honor.
Okay, can you point to the transcript where that specific issue of undue influence was raised? I was unable to find anything.
Okay. I guess I can't specifically recall when that was raised. I thought I raised that at the close. In my closing argument.
Okay, so it might be in the closing argument then.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Rufinick, one of your witnesses that the district court did not find credible supported your case. Could you give me a substance of what that person was saying? I think it was a nurse, am I wrong? I thought there was one witness who was supporting you at the hearing.
Yes.
What was the, I don't have the trial transcript in front of me, what was the gist of her arguments that favored your position today, sir?
She basically said that he was under diminished capacity.
Okay.
You know, the people in a people like him in a vulnerable condition can make responses about money owed to them, and that could be today or could be 20 years ago. There's no ability to show that he. That was, you know, something that was in something that, you know, was current. You could get anybody to, you know, if when they're in that condition, they're so vulnerable, and they could be influenced so easily by the slightest.
No, I got it. I mean, you could know who the president is, but maybe you don't know anything else. So
yes,
I understand the argument. Thank you, sir.
You know, I think all the totality of the circumstances show that he had, you know, he had incapacity to form and write a will, that it was contrary to that, and the court's findings were contrary. They did not follow the well-established law that required specific capacity to enter, write a will. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rufinack. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. Your Honors, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Kendra Olson. I'm an attorney representing Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church as the proponent of the will signed by Mr. Larson on January 24th, 2014. As an appeal from a court trial, the evidence in this case is largely found in the trial transcript. And that evidence all tends to show that Mr. Larson both had capacity and was not subject to undue influence by those around him at the time of the signing of his will.
Was the issue of undue influence raised in the district court?
Your Honor, I believe if it was raised, that it may have been raised in appellant's closing argument. However, I don't believe that there was any evidence presented in support of that argument. Evidence would have had to come in the form of testimony from those who were around him, and I believe a review of the testimony from, for example, Mark and Myron Wickland or Adam Licari or others doesn't support a finding of any undue influence. Mr. Larson, of course, was a bachelor and a lifelong farmer whose farmland was actually located just across the highway from Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church. The close proximity was meant that this was his family farm, and so he grew up there and spent his entire lifetime attending Leaf Mountain Church. It was held in a hugely important place in his heart.
He rang the bell.
He rang the bell and called the worshipers in. Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church, I think it's important to note, isn't a large church. It's a more like a family of around 30 members. And that's been sort of a steady number, give or take, over the recent history of the church. Of course, everyone at the church knew Mr. Larson, and he would have known all of them. His health did start to deteriorate in late fall of 2013, right around Thanksgiving time. There was testimony from Mark Wickland indicating that, you know, his appetite was not what it used to be and that he was just not feeling well. Amazingly, Mr. Larson was still farming at this time. He was 81 years old and maintaining a small herd of cattle and cutting his own hay. After he started to not feel well, he was treated initially with hydration and iron to help with some anemia that was appearing. But it wasn't until a bit later that he was ultimately diagnosed with renal cancer. Appellant in this case suggests a dangerous precedent that merely by having those that are important to a person around them at the time of their death, that necessarily means undue influence. Although there's no perfect estate plan, the estate plan that is made by the testator is better than the one that is offered by the state. Mr. Licari,
what significance is, you know, the policy of the hospital or nursing rules or whatever vis-a-vis visitors to a hospital room? Is that relevant to our analysis of undue influence or of testamentary capacity, or where does that fit in?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it's important, especially because there is no apparent policy that would forbid a person from having visitors while they're in a nursing home. Having reviewed the addendum that Mr. Ruffinex supplied to his brief, it's important. I don't have legal support for this, but it's important for people in nursing homes to have guests and to have people come to see them. The congregation of Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church filled that gap. Exhibit 55, I believe, was a notebook that had been placed in Mr. Larson's room by one of the congregants of Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church. I believe it was Mrs. Flatten, as a way of the members communicating with each other about who was coming to visit Mr. Larson in his final days. The list is long, and he had visitors on an almost constant basis, and almost all of them are members of the congregation. Not only was there testimony by Ms. And actually, I will address for the court was inquiring about Ms. Mandy Larson, who whose last name is a mere coincidence, as often happens in our state, that she has no relation to the Larsons in this case. She did perform some cognitive assessments, and the results of those did find that Mr. Larson was depressed, which shouldn't be surprising, finding that about 3 weeks before he had been independent, 3 or 4 weeks before he had been independently farming and living on his own, now he found himself in a nursing home. He was no doubt struggling with mortality.
Wouldn't that be a fairly strong indication of there might be an issue with respect to mental capacity if somebody's severely depressed?
I think there's a very important distinction here, Your Honor, to make between mental capacity and mental health. Having a finding of depression or anxiety or any of these other conditions doesn't mean that a person isn't able to understand what's going on around them. It's an indication of their mood more than their abilities. Ms. Larson did make that finding, but she also said, you know, when she was there to witness the will signing, that was her signature. She would never let one of her patients sign one of these documents, and unless she believed that they were able to do so. Robert Reinbold, also as a witness to this will, had a longer relationship with Mr. Norman Larson than most could say. Although it was a distant relationship, Mr. Reinbold is a banker at the First National Bank of Henning, and would see Norman Larson coming in and out on a regular basis. He himself admitted in his testimony that he was concerned on his way over from the bank to the living center of what he was going to find when he got there, whether or not Norman would be able to have capacity. And he also testified that he was relieved to find that he was quite convinced that Norman was able to sign that will. Also important in this case is the testimony and the documentation provided by attorney Adam Licari. Licari was first contacted by Myron Wickland. So Myron Wickland was the president of the Congregation of the Church during all these relevant times. He's also a distant cousin of Norman Larson and a lifelong friend. Myron was there when Norman received his diagnosis of renal cancer, and Norman is the one who asked Myron to help him get his affairs in order.
Is it Mr. Licari? Do I pronounce that?
Licari.
Does the record indicate, is he also counsel for the church?
No, Your Honor, he was not.
Thank you.
Mr. Licari was contacted by Myron at the firm of Kennedy Carlson Van Bruggen, which had no prior relationship with Leaf Mountain Church. He met with Myron on two instances, first on January 22nd, and then finally for the will signing on January 24th, both in 2014. Mr. Licari took notes after each of these meetings and made memoranda to his file. All of these are support the finding that Mr. Larson had capacity at the time that he signed his will and knew exactly what he was doing. Mr. Licari and Mandy Larson both represent independent witnesses in this case, and their testimony holds, actually Mr. Reinbold as well, excuse me, all of them had nothing to gain from establishing this estate plan, and their testimony holds great weight. No testimony has been offered that contradicts what they had to say. Further, the testimony of those who were around Mr. Larson before and after his will signing also supported the fact that he was competent, that he knew what he was doing. Mr. Mark Wickland testified that he found Norman to have a sense of relief. In contrast, the testimony by Ms. Mary Larson, who is the wife of the petitioner, she didn't see Mr. Larson until a day or two before his death, which was about a week after the signing of the will. And he had, of course, deteriorated significantly by that time. This was definitely an estate plan that was done in a hurry, but it was done in time. And for that, the church is grateful. Finally, Your Honors, I'll note that this isn't the first gift that Mr. Larson made to the church. He made an outstanding gift of over $62,000, which in Otter Tail County and in this part of the state is a great gift to build a fellowship hall for the church and to help his members. And that was something that he enjoyed seeing the church use on a week-by-week basis. And in conclusion, Your Honors, Leaf Mountain Lutheran Church has offered the testimony of several competent and uninterested witnesses to support the findings of the district court that Mr. Larson had capacity, was not and was not subject to undue influence, while the appellant in this case has offered no evidence and certainly not clear and convincing evidence that is required in order for this court to overturn the district court's findings. And therefore, Your Honors, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Mr. Rufinack, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose to exercise.
Yes, I think the evidence of the totality of the circumstances, the policy of the state and federal government to not allow people into the nursing home to do whatever they have other than immediate family members. It's quite clear none of these people were immediate family members. The attorney was brought in.
Mr. What policy? I'm just a little confused. What policy are you referring to? Friends get to, I don't understand what you're talking about. There's a policy that says in a nursing home, friends can't visit you? I'm unaware of this. What?
That's federal, it's state guidelines for nursing homes.
That friends can't visit, what? Friends, there's a federal and state guideline that says friends can't visit someone in a nursing home?
Without the specific authorization.
Of the family?
Of the family or the person in the nursing home. There's no evidence that shows that he himself made the choice to allow any of these people into the nursing home.
But there's no evidence he objected or didn't welcome his church family as they came to visit him in his final days.
Well, if he didn't understand who was there because of his severe depression and the fact that he was in a substantial coma,
The coma was days before, though.
The coma was days before.
And the attorney met with him on January 22nd to have the initial consultation with him, and then met with him on January 24th, talk to him.
At the time he had it, he had not made any sort of testamentary capacity, did not give him instructions on who to write a will. He wrote
prior to. That's not uncommon for people to put together basically a deathbed will.
It's not uncommon, but most people, if they're going to do that, would give instructions to their attorney as what to prepare. There was no indication that he in the follow-up on it, that he had any personal contact or any telephone contact with the decedent as to the instructions of what to put in the will.
He met with them beforehand to find out what he wanted to do with respect to his will and to his.
Yes, he did meet with him, but at that time he didn't have any instructions to him on what he wanted to do. He gave him nothing to follow up on.
But the attorney had notes summarizing the meeting with him and what he wanted to put together in terms of his will, how he wanted to divide it, what he wanted to give to the church, what he wanted to give to his.
I don't believe that was on that day that he initially met with him, and I don't think he got back to him either on the phone.
Well, does that really matter? Because we have a will that was put together, that was presented to him, that he signed on January 24th, and that all the witnesses, including the attorney, who had no interest other than just providing a service to a client, that this reflected what he wanted to do. So it seems like you've got two arguments, but it sounds like your undue influence argument is really based on the fact that your argument that he did not have mental capacity. And you said a lot of issues that he had physically, but physical capacity is different from mental capacity. But it sounds like it's really resting on the mental capacity argument.
Yes. I think all the, you know, the evidence support that if, you know, he had the stroke and that given specific instructions on how to do it was severely depressed on the day or within hours of the will being executed, that all the totality of that evidence shows that he did not have.
But this is a self-executing will, and you don't contest the fact that it is a self-executing will, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Rufinack. Your time is up. The matter is submitted.